Hi and welcome to the Australasian Special Events 2020 project. I'm Trevor Connell, and like all of you, I'm currently practicing physical distancing from my friends and peers. But rather than being stuck in social isolation, each week I'm Zooming in with someone who has made a career in our event industry and asking them to share their story. So today we meet Mary Took. Mary, where and when were you born?
Oh, I was born in London in the UK in February 1954.
And tell us about your early life growing up in London.
I grew up in a strongly religious family, so we spent a lot of time going to church, etc. I did very well in primary school. I was quite bright and managed to sort of be ahead of the game a little bit. I learned to read before I went to school. When I got to school and everyone was learning how to read, I was already doing sort of third and fourth year books. So they had to send me off to the library to keep my mind active, if you know what I mean. But of course, eventually they all caught up to me. But when I was 10 years old, I got a scholarship to go to Christ Hospital, which is the oldest school in England. It was established in the 9th century, I believe. It was a wonderful opportunity, but my father ended up migrating to Australia, or the whole family did, and so I didn't end up going to a very elite posh public school in the end. But it was a very poor background. We didn't have any money. My father was a computer operator for Gillette, and moving to Australia was probably the best thing he ever did, and I'd be very grateful to him for doing that.
So how old were you when you came to Australia?
I was 11 years old, and we already had worked out with the South Australian Housing Trust that we would have a house in Elizabeth, which was a migrant suburb at the time. We moved into our little house in Elizabeth in 1965.
And did you continue schooling?
Yes. My father insisted that I go up a year, so I went to high school a year earlier than most, which was good from the academic tracking, but it meant that I was a little bit less mature than my peers. In lots of ways. I ended up going to university when I was 16 years old. So it all sort of happened very fast.
And what did you study at uni?
At university, I studied physics and mathematics, pure mathematics and applied mathematics.
With a view to doing what after you left?
I had no idea.
Right.
I was much more interested in my role as the music editor for the OnD, for the student magazine, and my role in organising the Vietnam moratorium.
Which university were you at?
At the University of Adelaide.
Yeah, tell us more about that time.
Well, you know, most of my friends were into drugs at the time, obviously, and I was into drugs, but I wasn't so desperate as some of them, I suppose you could say. But I was very much into music and I wanted to become a musician. So all of my friends were in bands. I was on the committee of the Jazz, Rock and Blues Club and did the music reviews. And I was also a member of the film club. And every Wednesday lunchtime, I think it was, we would show some exotic film from, you know, Ingmar Bergman or Rossellini or one of those, you know, noir French or Italian or Swedish directors. So we were very cultured. And every Friday lunchtime in the Union Hall, we'd have a rock concert. And bands would come to Adelaide in those days. Most of the big bands would play at the Union Hall, play a Friday lunchtime concert, and then they'd head off and play a series of gigs over the weekend. And then Monday morning, they'd drive back to Sydney or Melbourne or Perth or wherever they came from. So
any memorable bands from that time?
Oh, they were a lot of memorable. Sirius, featuring Jackie Ozarski. Mm-hmm. Bakery, I remember watching Bakery play. Yeah. Spectrum, Daddy mm-hmm. Cool played there. Fraternity with Bon Scott, who were an Adelaide band, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so really the cream of Australian bands came through there. Billy Thorpe played there one time. And so we were spoiled, really.
And were you involved playing at that time?
Yes, I was in a little Adelaide band myself. I played percussion. Ended up dropping out of university after a couple of years and heading to Melbourne to see if I could make my living as a musician.
And did you?
Well, no. So I followed my dream for about 6 years. I worked very hard at it. I tried really good, but I don't think I really had a great deal of talent. I did get chosen by Skyhooks to be their percussion player on the Heat of the Night tour in 1974. So, you know, I was there playing in front of 15, 20,000 people in big arenas when they were at their peak. And I ended up joining a band called Panther, who are a very good sort of reggae funk band. And we travelled around and had quite a good following. I mean, we had a lot of fun, but I don't think I was destined really to become a musician for the rest of my life.
Anything interesting from that Skyhooks tour?
There are stories that we can't tell, of course. But, you know, it was fraught with danger being on a Skyhooks tour. I remember having to throw a 14-year-old girl out of my hotel room when I discovered that her father was the mayor of Dubbo. But we'll leave it at that. That was the first time I met Michael Chugg, actually, the promoter on the tour.
Yeah.
And we flew into Dubbo on a private plane from Melbourne, the whole band. And Michael Chugg was on the tarmac with a big cigar hanging out of his mouth and what they call a 10-gallon hat, like a big old cowboy hat. Introduced himself to everybody. But yeah, I mean, that was a lot of fun. But in the end, when I was working with Panther, I really befriended the roadies and actually used to help them set up. When Bob Dylan came into town in 1978, he had a big concert and he needed a lot of crew. And the Panther boys, Philip Trakoulis and Harry Parsons, found out about the job and they said, do you want to come do some work on the weekend? So I helped set up the Bob Dylan concert and the Sydney Cricket Ground, I think it was, the Sydney Showgrounds, one of the two. I made more money in a four-day weekend than I'd made in the last 6 months playing music, and I loved it.
So I think that was the infamous wet concert, wasn't it? Is that the one?
Extremely wet. I distinctly remember thousands of dollars of very expensive black velvet getting completely drenched, and we literally had to fold it up and put it back into containers to go back overseas. And there was big question marks about whether we should have just thrown them in the bin because they wouldn't have made the sea journey. But those were interesting times, indeed.
Yes.
But as a result of that, I ended up picking up a lot more crewing work, just working as a loader really on concerts. And the thing I noticed, Trevor, was that the people organising the crew were mostly drug addicts and were totally unorganised. So I took it on myself to approach Eric Robinson, who was one of the founders of Jans, and a senior production manager on most of the shows. And I just said, where do you get this crew from? You know, like, you know, why do you use this? He said, well, they're the only ones we can get. I said to him, well, what if I start my own crewing service and I guarantee that I'll get good, really good people for you? And he said, okay, give it a go. So next day I went down to wherever you register business names, and I registered the name Sydney Crewing Service. And I called him up and I said, okay, I've got the business now. Tell me what you want. So we started booking all the casual labour and all the crews, and we ran that for a number of years, and it even kept going in my absence when I went overseas. But that was the first professional crewing service in Sydney, started in 1978. And the point of difference that I had, Trevor, was that I actually didn't use, you know, drug-addicted street people as loaders. I actually got professional roadies who were working with bands. In between tours, they would make themselves available to me. So, you know, they got extra money. I got the best people. My customer got the best people. And, you know, it turned out just a much better result for everybody. But there were different times back then. I'd go to the Sydney Entertainment Centre at 1 o'clock in the morning and collect the money in a brown paper bag. Okay. And on Monday morning, I'd sort of work out who got what. That was the first of the professional crewing services. And then I became really sort of interested in lighting at the same time. And so I could run the crewing service and sort of get involved in the lighting. And then I got asked if I would go on some big international tours. I got pretty good at it pretty quick. I managed to go out on some of the biggest international tours that came through Australia and New Zealand at the time. People like, you know, Kiss and Elton John and The Police, Cher, and, you know, a lot of the major acts. I ended up becoming a lighting crew chief. That was sort of my next passion after music. It was lighting.
And this was still the days of park hands.
Yes, many park hands.
Many.
It wasn't unusual. It were hundreds. It wasn't unusual for us to put up 400 park hands in the lighting rig. Aircraft landing lights. And
yeah.
All of the beautiful things.
What sort of desks were you using back then?
Well, they were analog pretty much. So I actually owned the prototype of the first JL3612 and with the pin matrix. I bought the actual prototype serial number 001. I bought Jans because I went out and became the lighting guy for Cold Chisel. I found out that Cold Chisel didn't currently have a lighting guy and were going on tour. So I went to their office and I just walked in. I said, "Oh, hi, I'm your new lighting guy. And I come with my own desk." I got the job.
You got the job. And how long did that go for?
Until I broke my leg on New Year's Eve, 1979. And I spent the first day of the 80s in Adelaide Hospital with a broken leg. I came off a truss 8 metres in the air. It's a long story, but a piece of rigging equipment that should not have been used at all actually failed.
A common story around those decades.
Well, more common with people that died in truck accidents.
Yeah.
Being fatigued and driving and drinking and driving and, crashing trucks.
Going overnight from one gig to another. Mr. Barnes was very well known for his drinking on stage at that time. What was it like for the rest of the band and the crew?
Well, I mean, for the crew, it was a lot of hard work, but we had a really excellent crew. You know, we just took a lot of pride in what we were doing, I think all of us thought there was absolutely no doubt that we were working with the best band in the country, that it was a privilege and an honour to be able to work with them, watch them every night of the week. I mean, there were a couple of nights when Jimmy got so drunk he could barely finish the set. And there were a couple of times when Jerry Georgettis, the sound guy, went into the band's dressing room afterwards and said, "I don't set up for 8 hours for you guys to play that kind of shit. Fucking do better." And Jerry was the sort of person the band would actually listen to.
Right.
So, but it was a very much a family, like a family thing. You know, the band and the crew, there was no real sort of us and them. We worked hard, they worked hard. We were all on this incredible journey at the time, and, they were at the peak of their powers, and they were playing 2,000 people every night in some pub or club somewhere in Australia. It was brutal. The music was amazing.
Yeah, I remember when albums came out in that era, and within a week we'd know the words to every song on the album.
Yeah.
Because we'd played them, so played the vinyl so hard.
Yeah, and it really was a golden age for Australian bands and music. But I ended up, I was on an Elvis Costello tour.
After the broken leg recovered.
This is like 1982. And I was touring with Elvis, and it came out that they had a spare ticket to London. Do you want to use the ticket? You want to come to London with us? And I thought, oh, that sounds great. So I quickly organised a passport in about 24 hours and left my crewing service in the very capable hands of my housemate, Julie Scoble, who ran it brilliantly while I was away. And then I took off overseas for a couple of years, and I got to London and went to see the boys at Tasco. I said, "What tours have you got coming up? You want a decent lighting guy?" I said, "Well, we've got this tour coming up with Neil Young, and would you like to go on that?" And I said, "Well, what are you paying?" I can't remember the numbers, like £50 a day. I said, "What's the crew boss get?" I said, "The crew boss gets $75. I said, "Okay, well, I'll be the crew boss then." "Oh, hang on a minute. We've got some very experienced guys." I said, "Well, I don't care who you got. They won't be as good as me. So you make your decision." So next day I got a phone call and said, "Would you like to crew boss the Neil Young tour in Europe?" So that was the next sort of part of the journey, touring through Europe, doing major festivals with the international rock act. And then when that sort of finished, Neil said, as a thank you, I'd like to fly you all home first class. I said, "Well, I don't have a home at the moment. I'm a vagrant." He said, "Well, why don't you come back to California with us?" So I flew back to America with Neil and his family and ended up living in one of the houses on his ranch for 6 weeks and just sort of chilling out with him and the crew and those lads. Got his horses fit, rode his horses, and ended up going, this is very lovely, but I need to get some work. So I went back to LA and started picking up some work with some local bands. But I did American tours with Neil, and I did INXS's first tour when they first went to America. They discovered that I was in Los Angeles and said, "Oh, we need a production guy because we're going out supporting the Kinks and Adam and the Ants, and we need a production guy to make sure, we get looked after and we don't get shafted as the support band." So I was that person. Also did their lighting for them. But my first major move into what we then call business theatre or corporate theatre was I got a phone call from a mate of mine who used to work for, who worked for Disney on Parade, and he'd been in touch with the boys from LaserVision, who were sort of pioneers of laser shows, and not LaserVision, I can't remember the name of them, Laser Media, I think they might have been called, pioneers of laser show, rock shows. And they had this opportunity show for Apple Computer, who were launching a new Macintosh in 1983. And they'd organised a big theatre in Hawaii, and all the Apple people who sold Apples, or resellers they called them, were going to go to Hawaii, and they wanted to launch the Macintosh to them. So he said, oh, we've got the opportunity to pitch on this job. And this was a Friday night. I think we spent the whole weekend sort of designing a show, putting a budget together, costing it. Went in on Monday morning and said, this is what we're planning to do. We had set pieces, neon, and we had 35 millimeter projection, and video projection was very much in its infancy back then and was pretty crap, to be honest. A lot of people were still doing multi-projector slideshows. But we put this whole multimedia thing together around it and worked out the budget. Budget we worked out was around about $500,000 to do the whole thing. And so we hand drawn on pieces of A3 paper, went into an agency in Los Angeles on the Monday morning, and we're sitting in the boardroom, and the guy said, can you give us a minute? Came back out and said, oh, well, we've just spoken to Apple, right? They love the idea. What do we need to start? I said, well, we need a 50% deposit so that we can start putting all the production in place. We walked out of there with a check for $250,000 American, and we didn't even have a bank account to put it in. But that showed. So then we went to Hawaii and did the show, and it was an absolutely huge success. One of the defining moments being Steve Jobs walking out on stage to a standing ovation to 5,000 people that lasted for 8 minutes and 24 seconds, I believe it was. I was timing it because I was stage manager. I was also calling the show. And I just thought, I could never see anything like this in my life. And, you know, there was a panel with Jobs and Bill Gates and the guy who founded Lotus, three-person sort of panel on the stage. And, you know, which is, I've seen some very old YouTube footage of it. But to really, that was 1983. That was pretty much the birth of the special events industry, when modern American companies especially decided that they wanted to use rock and roll technology to make their presentations more interesting and more. Yeah, so we did all that and then came back to Australia in 1983 and started a company called Production Techniques. And we specialized in providing production services for the special events industry, which, as I said, was absolutely in its infancy. I mean, there were about two or three AV companies, about three or four event producers as such. It was very much a cottage industry.
Audience Motivation would have been around at the time.
Audience Motivation with David Beale were one of the AV companies, Penta, Prudenstein. But they got into it because they used to make slides.
Yeah.
And then the Dataton and all the technology came in so you could do multi-projector shows. You know, Vision then was all about multi-projector shows. As I said, video was in its infancy, very, very low quality.
Mm.
So couldn't really get nice quality pictures out of video at all back then. And not for a long time after.
And they were three-gun projectors that took ages to set up and focus and so forth as well.
Yeah, it wasn't just the projectors, it was the source material. So yeah. Until Beta came along, you couldn't actually show anything with any reasonable quality. Mm. So then we started Production Techniques, and that lasted for about 6 years. We discovered that we were really, really good at putting on shows, but we were really, really bad at running a business. And we ended up going broke in 1989 and just sort of got out of it through the skin of our teeth and not losing our houses. But we learned a lot of lessons along.
So what was 88 like for Production Techniques?
Yeah, well, 88 was a bumpy year. State 88 was a massive show that we were involved in.
Which was the opening of the of SCEC.
Of the convention centre. And we were involved in that, not to the degree that we wanted, but we did the Bicentennial Wall Collection for Rick Birch down in the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive show with a lot of sort of untested, untried technology, hydraulic screens that lifted up out of the stage. And we were always pushing the boundaries, always taking risks, like trying stuff that nobody had ever tried before and putting it into a show. It was insane, the stuff we did. And then we did that Bicentennial Wall Collection with Charles and Diana in the Bicentennial Concert, the Royal Bicentennial Concert in the Sydney Entertainment Centre, Chuck and Diana. And we did that. And we did a number of big things for Lendlease around that time. But then, of course, we had the bubble burst, didn't we? So, you know, you talk about peaks and troughs and everybody's talking about COVID now. So, you know, we've been through a number of peaks and troughs. And when the bubble burst in 1989, there was nothing, no government money, nothing. So we'd all been working our asses off in 1988. In 1989, we had nothing to do. That was when Production Techniques had to give up, went under. And then I went back to my sort of rock and roll production managing rock and roll tours, working with people like Bruce Springsteen, and Neil came back to Australia. I worked with him and Diana Ross and you know, and other international artists. But I realised quite quickly that if I was going to have any kind of success in the world, I couldn't just be a freelance production person with only one stream of revenue being totally proportional to the number of hours in my day. So in 1990, there was sort of fairly... In 1989, we did a massive Land Cruiser launch with Peter Wick, who's one of my close friends and sort of still one of the, in my view, an industry leader, a captain of industry. And we did this Land Cruiser launch in the Tennis Centre in Melbourne. And we needed a kilometre of black velvet drape, and I literally had to get every single black velvet drape from everywhere I could find in Australia. I had stuff coming in from Perth and Brisbane and Hobart, and just had to cobble together this measly collection. And I decided there was a big hole in the industry. So I started staging rentals in 1990, in the middle of a recession.
Yeah.
And bought up all the risers from the Elizabethan Theatre Trust and the Sydney Prop Centre and every drape that I could find, and bought some rolls of black velveteen and black corduroy. We started making our own drapes, and then that's how we started staging rentals.
So before we go into the staging rental story, around about that time, you also were involved with the School Spectacular.
No, that was a bit later.
Oh, was it?
My involvement in the School Spectacular probably started around about the same time that, or a little bit after I started staging rentals.
Ah, right. Well, tell us that story anyway as to how that came about.
I don't remember. All I remember was that I was production manager for the School Spectacular for 17 years. I actually don't really remember how it came about. It probably came about from a conversation I had with Mary Lopez, who had sort of ambitions for her little show to be a lot bigger than it was. And I think because I had the staging company and I could make big things, there was an opportunity there to sort of expand the staging elements of the show. So she sort of came to me to talk about, you know, what would be possible, given that they were in the Sydney Entertainment Centre and it was a big show and had lots of kids. And she sort of wanted to sort of pick my brains on some design expertise on how to put up the big orchestra and how to mount the choirs and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so out of that relationship, I became the production manager. Bruce Harris was still involved. Rolf's brother was the sort of executive producer at the time.
Yeah,
we just took it from there and we grew the show from what it was into a sort of a... And it's now, of course, just a television show, really.
Yeah.
An audience. But yeah. And the formula hasn't really changed much over the years. To be honest, after 17 years, I just really had enough of it.
Mm.
But because it just wasn't that interesting from a show point of view. But, you know, worked with some lovely, lovely, lovely people.
It's an interesting story as to how it came about in the first place, which was when they opened the entertainment centre, they wanted to basically test how it could cope with big crowds and putting the kids through. Do you remember that part of the story?
Well, I do, but I came in a couple of years after that.
Right.
So Norman Copeman, I think, was looking after it at the time.
Mm.
You know, and they had no money. And then, you know, once they'd done a couple of them on a fairly low budget, they decided that, you know, they wanted to keep taking it to the next level. I mean, there were some frightening levels of ambition in the department at the time. But it was good, you know. Of course, Mary was at the front, sort of, you know, leading the charge.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's try something new. You know, trying to bring in creative people who all had crackpot ideas. And there was, you know, little old me sitting in the background trying to help them make it.
And it was your involvement in that got you involved in the Paralympics ceremonies in 2000?
No, not specifically, no.
Ah.
But the experience of doing that did help. A lot.
Right.
No, it was more my relationship with Rick Birch. And Rick's offsider at Spectac was Karen Richards. And Karen Richards got the job. When Rick got the job to be production director of ceremonies for the Olympics, Karen got the job to be production director of ceremonies for the Paramount. And I'm pretty sure I was the first person she called. So I became the production director for that event. It was a very, very small team. John Raymond was there doing the lighting, but he was also involved with the Olympics because we realised very early on that we'd need to share the infrastructure of the Olympics, that we couldn't just tear out the Olympic ceremonies and then 3 weeks later put in the Paralympic ceremonies. So there had to be a bit of a dovetail on that. And then I brought in Peter Milne to be the technical director because one of the ideas from Amy Darcy was the main designer. And one of Eamon's main ideas was to have a 90-meter wide by 6-meter high projection surface with, it was at that time, it was the biggest panoramic screen that had ever been built anywhere in the world. That was the main backdrop for the Paralympic opening ceremony staging. But it was a very small team. Production meetings, there'd be 5 or 6 of us in a production meeting. We'd just bring in people as we needed them. We only had a budget of $5 million. The Olympics had a budget of $100 million, but I think they spent probably closer to $150 million in the end. It was a wonderful show and a wonderful experience. But even despite the fact that one of the windiest days ever,
yes,
in September 2000, tore our 90-meter by 6-meter projection screen to absolute shreds. And we had about 3 days to make a new one, albeit out of much stronger material. We tried to use a proper projection surface and it just wasn't outdoor rated. So we ended up in some beautiful sail person to make us a huge canvas one, which did the job, which we should have done the first place, but hey, you live and learn. That's how you learn, by mistakes.
So, and the Olympics itself, what was the year like for you? Because you had staging rentals up and running by then.
Well, most of our Olympic involvement was in the peripheral sort of events. You know, there'd be little activations in the Olympic Village and the corporate sponsors would do things. We didn't actually get much in the way of so-called work as such. Because we did help with some of the ceremony stuff. We did help make some of the ceremonies bits and pieces. But once again, you know, the same as what happened in 88 and 2001, the Olympic bubble burst. So, you know, we all had this glory year in 2000. And in 2001, you had nothing to do. All the corporates had spent all their budgets and the money dried up. So, yeah, and then we all had to sort of downsize again, scale down. But we ended up managing to fill that gap because Peter Ricks approached us and said, I want you guys to start building my motor shows. So we started building motor show stands for Toyota and Lexus and eventually Nissan. And we did some stuff for Hino as well with the truck shows. But that became, you know, a massive operation. A new Toyota stand, back then, built, installed, you know, around the $1 million mark. Very high levels of technical alongside it. So, boots and lighting and all of that as well. So, we started working with guys like Ziggy Ziegler, you know, brought him in to do the lighting and started to bring a lot of that rock and roll technology and ethos into what was fundamentally back then an exhibition.
I mean, the motor shows in those days, I mean, they'd take up the entire SCEC or MCEC, wouldn't they?
5 halls at the SCEC, yeah. Massive, absolutely massive. But, you know, it became a bit of a sort of a dick-swinging competition between the parks. And, you know, so Toyota would turn up with a brand-new stand and the next year Holden would have to have a brand-new stand. And it was a show that ate itself. It just made itself too big and too ugly and too expensive. And eventually the money minders at the top of the motor car corporations are going, why are you spending $1 million on a motor show stand? If we spend $1 million on television advertising, we would sell a lot more cars. And they were right. So, you know, that ended up kind of crumbling, of course. But, you know, back in those days in the mid-noughties, mid to late noughties, before the GFC, that's where all the money was in the special event industry in that area. And then, of course, the GFC, the next bubble burst in 2008. Yeah. We all had to shrink down again. So our 35 full-timers became 21, I think. I've had to oversee a lot of redundancies in my time.
So did you have any saving grace in the GFC? Yeah.
We survived it, but, you know, we'd had some experience in surviving it before. You know, you just do what you got to do. I mean, like, people are learning the hard lesson right now with COVID.
Yeah,
you just have to act and you have to be brutal and you have to act quick. Every day that you don't make a decision is going to cost you. It's a more interesting time than any time I've ever seen. And I wasn't involved in World War II, but I can imagine that the world has never been in a place like that since World War II.
So what's been some of the highlights of staging rentals and construction as it became?
Oh, there's almost too many to mention. Obviously building the opera, you know, the Handa Opera on Sydney Harbour, that massive Turandot set, the Aida, the giant head, the Carmen, the full-size tank and the full-size truck and, you know, opera stuff that was, you know, really challenging. We didn't make any money out of it. In fact, I think on Turandot we probably lost a couple of hundred grand. But, you know, there were wonderful shows to do. Our involvement with the Sydney Festival has been brilliant. A 10-year involvement with them as their sort of staging sponsor has been really fantastic. And then, you know, some brilliant corporate shows in our relationship with the George P. Johnson Company and their Toyota activations and different clients and supporting them with their different clients.
I mean, you've had a long relationship with Peter Rex.
I have, yes.
And that's been very productive for you.
In terms of creativity and not just creativity, just how to work together, how to work together in a team, how to form synergistic supplier relationships and how to get the best out of people. You hire the best people, you challenge them, you get them to do their best work and, you know, and then you produce something really wonderful for the client.
Yeah.
Bluntly, without sounding like an old man, those days are gone.
Mm.
It's now a much more like a master-servant relationship. And it's because it's all about the money. And people talk about creativity and, you know, I'm a creative director or a creative this or creative that. The truth of the matter is there's very little creativity in the industry anymore at all. It's pretty much plagiarism. So, I mean, we would pride ourselves, Trevor, on coming up with something nobody had ever done before. And you know, and now there's this obsession with trends. What's the trend? Well, you know, like, why would you want to follow the trend?
Mm.
Let's be the trend. Let's create the trend.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can only do that when you've got license. When you've got license for creativity to come to the fore, where you've got a client who's prepared to take a risk. You know, like with Toyota, when we did the Camry Expo, we took over an entire shed down at Pier 7 or Pier 8 or Pier 7 or wherever it was down in the water and just took it over for 3 months and built this incredible exhibition inside it. People can just travel through this experience. And it's the kind of risk people don't want to take these days.
Mm.
But the client profile's changed as well. You know, it's all the money now comes from the tech giants. You know, the Amazons, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Xeros, the Adobes, the IBMs. You know, that's where all the money is. And if you look at Google Summit or, you know, IBM Think or Adobe, whatever they call it, or Cloud Summit, or, you know, and you look at those gigs and you see them on Instagram, they all look the same. They all look the same. You know, maybe they get the job done for their client, maybe not. Anyway, that's all over because who knows what's going to happen when we come out of this COVID thing.
Mm.
Yeah, it could take 18 months to 2 years. Before the industry recovers.
Berejiklian was saying yesterday that the social distancing will be in place until a vaccine is found. And that could be 18 months, which means
Or never.
Or never, exactly.
Yeah. They've never found a vaccine for the common cold.
Or for AIDS.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, it's possible a vaccine will never be found. So, you know, either way, the world has changed forever. I mean, and there's good and bad things about it. You know, like people complain about the economy. Well, in my view, the economy is the problem. we could just get along a lot better, sharing things, caring more about each other. I mean, and it was part of the reason that we ended up shutting down our New South Wales operation. So that's been our big story of the last 2 years. And sort of the main reason I came back on board at the helm of Staging Rentals was to facilitate that wind down. And luckily for us, we got our timing pretty much spot on.
Yes.
By the time the shit hit the fan on the 13th, on Friday the 13th of March, we pretty much liquidated most of our assets. And now we just have our lovely little branch in Melbourne cranking along. And we've done a deal with those people to cut their hours and take leave and we put a survival plan in place. And that's sort of the next saga. How long we have to wait for the industry to bounce back before we can take advantage of our positioning.
Now, through your time, the latter few decades, you've been very involved with the associations in the in the industry. So let's talk about ISIS first up, because I think you were one of the founding members of the International Special Events Society Australian chapter, along with myself.
I was.
And you served as president for a while?
No, I was president-elect. I didn't go into the chair, and there was a reason I didn't go into the chair. It was because the leadership of the in America changed, and they decided that the Australian branch of ISIS couldn't act as a free agent anymore, and that we now had to remit 40% of our fees back to America. Mm. And my view was, I thought it was the International Special Events Society. I'm not particularly interested in being the president of the American Special Events Society Australian chapter. So unfortunately, I walked away. Mm. And poor old John Rohanna had to stay in a chair for 6 months. But it was the beginning of the end for ISIS, because the people in America were too greedy, and they didn't understand that a remote chapter of a special event society cannot be remitting fees back to a parent group in the US, because it would just change the whole subscription cost. So,
but if we go back to the beginning of the chapter, and because essentially at that time, it brought together the industry, and we pretty much all knew each other at the time. And so it was quite easy to come together as a chapter in Sydney.
Yes. And it was brilliant, because, you know, it would be an opportunity for us to get together, share ideas, you know, talk about the challenges that we were facing, you know, and back then we were actually committed to the growth of the industry, which is very different to what it's like now. I think most people in the industry were committed to the death of the industry, if you judge them by their actions. The way that the industry has become a whole master servant, and, you know, little staging companies and AV companies and little production companies at the bottom of the food chain are just getting hammered. And, you know, the fact of the matter is most of the people in that raft call it the race to the bottom. Mm. It's, you know, how much can you give me? How cheap can it possibly be? Will you still survive in business? Well, you don't have to answer that question anymore, because for the most part, you know, none of us are going to survive. Who knows what the industry will look like when we get out of COVID, but there won't be much of it left. There'll be companies who are still called that company by name only, but they won't have any work and they won't have any employees. So, you know, and, you know, a lot of the big names have shed, you know, 90% of their staff. No one knows, Trevor. No one knows what it's going to be like when we get out the other side. And what the economy is going to be like. The economy is going to be in tatters. And will these big spending tech giants want to still be the big spending tech giants that they were back then? Or will they all have found another way to do it? Now, the only way you can do an event is for every AV company is going to need video conferencing. And so it's video conferencing or die. There's no need at all for any staging companies or you know, the 10 companies are thinking about doing, you know, hoping they can get a job doing a temporary hospital. You know, it's very, very sad. Very sad.
I just want to go to the other association then, Mia, and I want to take you back to the awards dinner in Alice Springs.
Well, do you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, tell the story. Go on.
Look, I'm a great supporter of industry associations. I really think industry associations have a role to play, and I think senior players in the industry are beholden, in a way, to support the industry and to make the industry bigger and stronger. I mean, one of the problems you're seeing right now with the industry is we don't have a voice in government. So Becca, which is the Business and Men's Council of Australia, have some sort of voice and some sort, and they've tried hard to sort of represent the industry and lobby to government that, hang on a minute, you know, when the shit hit the fan, we were the first ones to suffer. Yeah. Like the minute that Scott Morrison said you cannot have meetings of more than 500 people, the industry shut down. It was Black Friday, it was the 13th of March.
Yeah, and by Monday it had closed.
Monday, the industry was dead. It was gone. We lost an entire multi-billion dollar industry over a weekend. And one of the reasons that we weren't represented very well, I think Becca tried really hard, But, you know, honestly, they don't get a lot of support. You know, when people, when everybody's doing well, they go, why do we need an industry association? And then when they're all suffering, it's, where's the industry association?
Yeah.
Right? You can't blow and suck at the same time. Yeah. Right? You want to support them, you want to be part of it, you know, then they can support you.
So Alice Springs.
Alice Springs. Well, I did go on a tangent. But so Alice Springs, the meetings and events, the National Award Show, which is the show that Mia put on to celebrate the best, you know, best special event, best this, best this, best this, best the other. Outstanding contribution, it's called, the award was called. And Ros McLeod was getting it. She sort of spoke a bit longer than the so-called 30 seconds that they'd allowed for. And the music came on. She was getting musicked off. I just couldn't stand it any longer. I stood up in my chair and I just screamed at the top of my voice, turn that music off now. And I don't know if you've heard me yell, Trevor, but it's quite loud, which it did. And then somebody must have panicked and turned the music off. And Rosalind got to finish her acceptance speech. And really, at the end of the night, that's all anybody ever wanted to talk about was Mary Took's rude interruption. But I approached Linda Gaunt, who was the CEO at the time, and I just said, if you're supposed to represent excellence in the industry, this can never, ever happen again. And she said, I agree. What do I have to do to fix it? I said, we've got a problem. I said, you've got an awards night, but you don't have a producer, and no one's in charge. And one of the rules, things that Peter Ricks taught me, was someone has to be in charge. You know, you can't run an event by a democracy. Everybody's got to have their job, but ultimately somebody, the shit has to stop, you know, somewhere. And then out of that, I became the producer of the Mayor Event Awards for the next 6 or 7 years. I can't remember, 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
But it was a love job, you know. Yeah. It was like, let's turn up to the Adelaide Convention Centre and see what we can do. And, you know, you're constantly trying to put together an entertaining and rewarding night, a night that rewards excellence with no budget. And so you, once again, you become completely dependent on the little handful of players who always put their hand up. And, you know, the other people who turn up who never put their hand up are the ones who sit around talking all the time rather than, you know, taking interest in the award. Yeah, so I did that for a number of years. There's a certain dynamic into putting on a really good awards night. And, you know, the important thing is to keep the talking to a minimum.
Is to keep
the talking to a minimum. Don't bore people, right?
Yes.
You know, in the end, Linda Gaunt had a 60-second speech, and that's all I let her do.
Yeah.
She says, "But I have to talk about the judging process." No, you don't. Mm. No one cares about the judging process. Right. They're here to find out who won, and they're here to drink and meet their friends.
Yeah.
But we did a number of, I think, really successful gala awards. You know, particularly memorable was the one on Hamilton Island. You know, and that was because of people like Andy, you know, from Song Division, who said, look, you know, we'll come and we'll do the music, we'll have it live. People like Toby Travener, who would MC it, who was always open to ideas. Yeah. You know, so we did, I think in Sydney one year, we did it like a Letterman style with him at a desk and a live band.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just so much more interesting, so much more entertaining. Yeah. But it's just, it's once again, it's creativity and imagination. It's like, it's the key to everything. And, you know, the minute you just let that drift away, you're lost.
So you've led a very busy life, Mary. What do you do to relax?
I ride a bicycle. So I love cycling and I love sailing. I have this wonderful cycling trip to Italy planned in May for 2 weeks. And followed by a week of sailing in Croatia.
How's that looking?
It's not looking very good. In fact, I think you could safely say it won't be happening. But that's sort of my... I've got a very interesting family. My two sons are both musicians in bands. My daughter is the general manager of my business and has been absolutely instrumental in us successfully navigating... the close down of the New South Wales operation. She's, you know, so I've got three brilliant kids, you know, and so trying to put a bit more sort of time into the family life, really, because there are more important things than work.
Well, on that note, Mary, I'd like to thank you very much for chatting to me for an hour. And I think that, it just comes down to family in the end, and that's all we've got.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't have love, you got nothing.
thanks for listening. I'd love to get your feedback, so please share your rating and comments in the appropriate place of your player or on the project website page. This podcast is produced by me, Trevor Connell, and edited by Samantha Latto. The theme music is composed and played by Duncan Latto.